So, Dr. Fallon is a real, genuine rocket scientist, space physicist from the University of Alaska. And you'll hear all about University of Alaska's facility, which sends electromagnetic radiation into the sky. You'll hear about what it does, what it doesn't do, how and why cats are sometimes involved. And I have a roll of tin foil, and we'll pass it around in case you feel the need to protect yourself from the emanations of Dr. Fallon, his talk, and his aura. So we're going to hear all about DTMF tones in space, and very pleased to introduce to you Chris Fallon.
Thank you, Greg. You're going to need more than that nice tinfoil hat to protect yourself from this talk. You'll probably need a tinfoil suit. And, you know, in Alaska, where it gets a little bit cold, we actually line our beanies, you know, with foil. You know, it's fashionable and functional. So I am the new chief scientist at HARP, the 3.6 megawatt radio transmitter in Alaska that people tell a lot of stories about, that HARP does a lot of interesting things, and this one is true, mostly. And this story begins with a poorly doctored internet picture of a giant cat sitting on a giant ionosphere heater. This ionosphere heater, beneath the cat, is known as HARP. And in full disclosure, there's a reasonable chance that management made me the chief scientist of HARP recently, in part to stop me from tweeting things like this. Otherwise, I'm free to talk about just about anything. I just can't tweet stuff like this anymore. And if you're a relatively normal person and you hear the word HARP, then it usually means one of a few things. The HARP with one A, it could mean a musical instrument. It could mean Irish beer, or it could mean subsidized home refinancing programs. And if you're over 50, and I know there's a few people over 50 here, then maybe you heard ARP, A-A-R-P, which provides resources to cope with aging. But if you've heard of HARP, the kind with an H and two A's, and an R and a P, then it usually means you're a fan in one form or another of conspiracy theories. HARP is, of course, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, the giant's 3.6 megawatt, or gigawatt, depending on how you count those watts, radio transmitter with a 40-acre phased array antenna consisting of 180 cross-dipole antennas or 360 dipoles, and every year, about next month, we have people visit the facility like you see on the screen, except for Eva there. She just walks around her home like that, unusual. She's a friend of mine. I don't quite know what's up with that. So a simple web search, if you just, you know, put this into Google or wherever, it says that HARP is a tool of the Illuminati or the global military-industrial establishment for mass mind control, triggering of precision targeted earthquakes, hurricanes, and floods, and a sprayer of chemtrails, whatever those are. And oral legend in Alaska, this is, you know, traditional stuff, even says that HARP can make the local caribou walk backwards in circles. And here I am about to reveal how HARP is simply used for humble little science experiments, esoteric experiments, and a little bit of fun, but mostly just science experiments, and mostly boring ones, or difficult to explain, and mostly both. But to be honest, I never really know how to give talks like this because there's so much material to cover, and my first inclination is basically to go through each and every one of Maxwell's equations for electromagnetism, all 17 of them in their original formulation, one by one, and how those effects apply to electromagnetic waves and their effects on a weakly collision-dominated plasma in our upper atmosphere. It'll take all night, approximately, at which point we will be ready to begin discussing the plasma physics that makes HARP more interesting than simply a giant radio. I've actually been discussing this particular slide for about 10 years now, and I'm happy to do so today for another 10. Or I could start by talking about the conspiracy theories. From the beginning. So it all starts with Alaskan Dr. Nick Begich, Jr., who is among the first to kick off the HAARP conspiracy theories when he published the book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP. It's published in 1995, largely predating the modern popular web, right when I was graduating from high school. And if his name sounds a little bit familiar, it probably means you've spent some time in Alaska if you haven't heard of these conspiracy theories, since Nick Begich is the brother of former Anchorage mayor and former Alaska U.S. senator and now current Alaska candidate for Anchorage governor, Mark Begich. Both are sons of Nick Begich Sr., who was elected to be the second ever Alaska U.S. House representative. And there is an entire story for that that is appropriate for another conspiracy-based talk that I don't have time for. HAARP was constructed incrementally from 1993 through the collective work of the U.S. Air Force, the Navy, DARPA, and the University of Alaska Fairbanks. 2 years or so before the Angels book was first published, BAE, as you know, is the prime contractor. It completed the construction in 2007, shortly before I became involved with the project. And it was completed by way of three main stages of operation, basically growing the antenna array and the power generation facility in three operational stages. And in a wink, or perhaps a poke to Nick Begich, the five 3,600 horsepower diesel engines that supply the power to HAARP, 12.5 megawatts or so of electrical power, those aren't actually named Angel 1 through 5. So angels do play this particular HAARP, as a matter of fact. And incidentally, you know, 12.5 megawatts, what does that mean? I don't know. It's approximately enough to power 2,500 typical American homes. I mean, and this picture is, that you won't see many places, is one of the generators arriving at the facility during construction. And anyways, in 1994, about 1 year before publishing Angels Don't Play This HAARP, Nick Begich earned the title of doctor, by the way of a PhD in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines in Sri Lanka, perhaps, allegedly, the largest degree mill in the world. And he continues to make money and energize the conspiracy theories through media appearances that all lead back to his website here, where he sells books, DVDs, and dietary supplements. And normally I would not take this stuff too seriously. I'm kind of a fun guy. I would actually be rather entertained by this sort of self-promotion and nonsense, and generally I am, because free speech really is a wonderful thing. I mean, let's get down to it. Free speech is a wonderful thing, but also we must be responsible about it. And when false speech in particular for selling things like books and pills has agitating effects on real people, real people with unfortunate and very real mental illness in some cases, then that speech, such as the things that Begich says about HAARP, that publicly accuse groups of people like me and other very nice people of basically practically destroying the planet with absolutely zero evidence in favor and a lot of evidence against, I think that speech needs to be really carefully considered or reconsidered against the negative ramifications of that speech on innocent people. And at the university, we actually keep a log of calls about HAARP, and many of these calls, if you listen to them or just read the logs, they are extremely disturbing. even threatening. They claim that HAARP is torturing them, to put it mildly, or causing various pains or ailments or things that we don't necessarily understand. And most of the times, HAARP is not operating at all, just not at all. And then there's this, which you may or may not have seen this news from back in October 2016. Two men were arrested in Georgia with a carload of guns and meth. And their stated intention for why they were doing this operation was to blow up HAARP and release the souls trapped inside or something. And I jokingly said, well, the souls are not stored at HAARP. We actually launched them into space from Poker Flat, and that also got me into trouble with management. So my personal opinion, not that of my employer, is that Nick Begich, if he really believes what he tells people about HAARP, and I have reasons to believe that he doesn't, to tell me the frequency, power, and modulation that we should use for the mind control effects or any of the nefarious things that he accuses us of doing, and I'll find a way to run that experiment. Let's see if it actually works. Let's test this with science in some way. And, you know, I'll do that. And if he's not willing or able to do that, then I think he should find another way to sell his books and his nutritional pills. And that is in part why I'm here giving talks like this, attempting to provide some signal to the noise. And obviously this effort backfires on occasion, such as when I give an interview to the Russian media. And to be honest, I probably should have known better, or that there would be some sort of Russian translation irregularities that translated HAARP to some sort of general purpose climate weapon. It's like a Swiss Army knife of mass destruction. Maybe. You know, they qualified it there, so that was kind of them. And fortunately, to a recent teleconference or a press conference in Finland with the American president and the Russian president, I really don't feel as bad about this as I used to. I have to thank them for that. But anyways, in all seriousness, as a scientist, I cannot disprove any of the conspiracy theories. I cannot prove what HAARP cannot do. That's just not possible. However, what is scientifically possible, if we're honest, intellectually honest about what science can do, is that I can say what HAARP can do and why we do it. So first of all, excluding the CO2 emissions emitted by the diesel generators at HAARP, HAARP only interacts with the ionosphere way ahead. Way above us. The ionized portion of the thermosphere above about 100 kilometers altitude, which is illuminated here by these TMA or trimethyl aluminum chemical tracers launched out of rockets from the UAF Poker Flat Research Range. And yes, the University of Alaska Fairbanks owns not only the HAARP facility, but also a rocket range that launches rockets into space, and yes, I think we're still accepting applications for fall. So there are elements of truth to some of the conspiracy theories, and in this case, in that both HAARP and chemical releases into space are used to study the upper atmosphere. In fact, there are a few scientists that use both techniques, radio modification of the ionosphere with facilities such as HAARP and others, and those that blow stuff up in space and watch what it does, though almost never at the same time. And even though most of us would love to do that, I would love to do that, I only do the HAARP stuff, but rockets that blow stuff up in space and HAARP, that is awesome science, really sticking it to space. And by space, I mean the upper atmosphere, even though there's virtually nothing there. This is actually why facilities such as HAARP can do anything at all to the atmosphere. It's only in a very limited region directly above the facility, far above, and it barely exists at all. And this diagram or mad scientist Google image search collage illustrates the environment that we're working with. At the bottom of the image, We have the troposphere, where most of our real weather occurs, and where we fly, and when we fly commercial, we're usually at the top of the troposphere. In the stratosphere, and that's where we have our protective ozone layer, and near the top of the stratosphere is where Felix Baumgartner made his famous stratosphere jump on the 14th of October, 2012. And notice a few things about that picture. From that altitude, the Earth looks round, partially because of the camera lens used, but also because at that altitude, the Earth really does have some curvature and looks round. Also, the sky looks black, even though it's in the middle of the daytime. And if you watch the video on YouTube, there's plenty of them. Listen to the audio. There's ones where he has a microphone in his helmet, and listen to it, and there is no sound, at least for a while, until he's fallen quite a distance. The wind is probably blowing about 100 kilometers an hour at that altitude, about 50 miles an hour or so, and it's about 50 kilometers altitude, and you wouldn't even know it. I mean, the wind is really blowing. And keep that in mind next time, not to ruin the Martian for you, but because that's the atmospheric density on the surface of Mars. It's not that different from the top of the stratosphere. And so wind really doesn't do much at that density except deorbit spacecraft relatively quickly. Otherwise, you wouldn't know. And for all practical intents and purposes, at least from the point of view of somebody without a spacesuit, Mr. Baumgartner is really in space. And we have to more than double that altitude before we get to the scientist's definition of space, about 100 kilometers altitude, near the lower boundary of the aurora, the approximate lowest altitude where HARP can have any effect at all. And which is, that's kind of where we try to do our VLF wave generation experiments. And we would have to double that altitude again to 200 kilometers to reach the point where low Earth orbit satellites hang out for a while, and where most HARP experiments take place, or at least where most of mine take place, in empty space, or almost empty. For all of the 3.6 megawatts, I mean megawatts, millions of watts of net radiated power at ground level focused into a beam that's about 5 to 20 degrees wide, and that results in an effective radiated power of hundreds of megawatts to a few gigawatts. The actual power density at the altitude where HARP is doing its thing to the ionosphere is actually less than 25 milliwatts per square meter, and often less than 1 milliwatt per square meter, thanks to the bane of anybody who needs to cover a large area with a wireless network like what we have here. RF power decreases with the square of the distance from the transmitter, and that inverse square law shows no mercy to HARP. It's also bound by the laws of physics. But what does that mean in an absolute sense? I mean, probably a few of us know. A few thousandths of a watt per square meter, is that important? Well, let's just say that the smartphone in all of our pockets, most of our pockets, that this can emit an entire watt per square meter, 1,000 times more per square meter, when held at arm's length, about a meter away. And so that means the electromagnetic flux through your brain is a nearly 1,000 times stronger than where HARP is messing with the atmosphere. And if you talk about the HARP waves that are bouncing back to Earth, they're another billion or 10 times weaker than they reflect back to the ground, you know, where they supposedly mess with minds. And so that's the problem with the inverse square law. And it's why, if I was a mad scientist that wanted to build a mind control machine, as Jesse Ventura accused us of doing, among others, Nick Begich also, I would never build something like HARP. No, I mean, that would be the dumbest way to do it. Instead, I would build a large distributed network of devices and somehow convince everybody on the planet to carry one, maybe two, everywhere they go, including to the toilet. But fortunately, I'm not a mad scientist. These days, I'm mostly an administrator. Having now suggested that the only reason we can modify this region of the atmosphere, the ionosphere, at all is because there's virtually nothing there to modify to begin with, why do we want to study that region at all? I mean, why is that important? Why do we want to modify it? Because this is an expensive operation. Well, I'll tell you why. It's basically because of this guy. Nikola Tesla. Not just, you know, New York City, Serbia, you know, that area, but, you know, New York City mostly, but also Colorado Springs near where I grew up. HARP is, after all, Tesla technology, which, you know, is the same as what Begich says, and this time he's right. But trivially, HARP is just basically a big radio, and Tesla is arguably the inventor of radio, more or less, and officially the inventor of alternating current. Marconi, who gets the credit, was the first to send a wireless message across the Atlantic Ocean and the first to develop practical radio for commercial applications, and he gets most of the credit, and Tesla was fine with that because he always said that Marconi did it with Tesla patents. And incidentally, Tesla also patented the drone. Some of you know that. And this one is a submarine, an invention that he did pitch to the U.S. Navy and War Departments as a device to end all wars. They weren't interested. They saw no future in either of those. So why do we care about the ionosphere? It's a space plasma, and space plasmas affect radio waves that we use for communication, navigation, and radar these days. This tenuous layer of the atmosphere is weakly ionized. That is, it's a small fraction of gas molecules or atoms that have positive charge and equal numbers of with the free electrons, and that's why we call it a plasma, or in this case, a space plasma. And while the gas is ionized, it's still electrically neutral. And most important, it affects radio waves, sometimes in a beneficial way, that allows us to communicate or detect objects at large distances beyond the horizon, and sometimes in a disruptive way that interferes with communication, radar, navigation. And sometimes large electric currents in the ionosphere driven by solar storms can disrupt our electric grids. And so this is a picture taken from the International Space Station, and you can see the green line emission from atomic oxygen. The brightest spot is about 100 kilometers altitude, near the lower boundary of the ionosphere. It reflects some frequencies of radio waves, which are useful. It absorbs other frequencies, preventing communication and detection. And some frequencies just pass right on through to space, which is useful for other reasons. And you can see the space shuttle Atlantis re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, and it is surrounded by a hot plasma that essentially prevents all forms of radio communication from and to the shuttle. So once again, we care about the ionosphere because it affects radio waves and a few other things. And it was, in fact, discovered through the unexpected success of Marconi's first transatlantic radio communication, a feat that the experts, the theorists and experimentalists in electromagnetism, as well as the companies that owned the overseas cables across the Atlantic that were charging huge fees, they said it was impossible. And it was impossible without an ionosphere or layer that was reflective to radio waves. However, in the 1930s, we discovered accidentally that not only can the ionosphere affect radio waves, but the powerful radio waves can also affect the ionosphere itself. And this slide is the first academic report of the effect in the journal Nature. And just as an aside, notice that the entire article fits on a single PowerPoint slide. And now Nature wants $35 a pop for this thing. But in my opinion, if the entire article fits on a PowerPoint slide, then sharing the entire article on this slide falls under the domain of free use. So you're welcome. And anyways, in 1933, home radio audiences in Holland listening to a distant radio station in Switzerland by way of the ionosphere reflection or refraction, they were really annoyed to hear the new and improved, more powerful Radio Luxembourg. in between them that just came online, even though it was transmitting on an entirely different frequency. They were hearing both sets of programming, the one on the channel that their radios were tuned to, and also programming on an entirely different channel. And this was sort of a big deal at the time. The radio engineers at Luxembourg, they were beleaguered with complaints. They quickly ruled out equipment malfunction, particularly since the effect was not observed at all locations. Listeners near Radio Luxembourg could only hear its own programming when tuned to the proper frequency, but not at the frequency of other weaker stations. And in fact, there was somewhat of a geometric effect observed where Radio Luxembourg could be heard when radio waves from distant stations passed over Luxembourg at the midpoint before the receiving audience. And eventually the engineers concluded that the signals from Radio Luxembourg, powerful Radio Luxembourg, were being mixed in space. That is, the signals were mixed in the upper atmosphere, in the ionosphere. A powerful radio wave with amplitude modulation like AM radio that a few of us still listen to will impart some of that modulation on other amplitude modulated waves traversing through that same region in the ionosphere. And so this cross-modulation effect, or Luxembourg effect, is the first instance that humans actually modified the ionosphere or the upper atmosphere, albeit in a very small and annoying way that somewhat interfered with the enjoyment of radio commercials. The Platteville High Power Facility was built in the 70s. The Department of Commerce built it for modifying the ionosphere as a scientific instrument, and it began operation in 1970 near Platteville, Colorado, coincidentally near where I originally grew up. It was a 2-megawatt transmitter with a frequency range of about 2.7 to 10 megahertz, essentially the same frequency range as HARP, and with about 56% the net power, although the difference is that HARP can focus that power into a much narrower beam with a higher power density. And Platteville is where the first so-called artificial aurora was created and measured, though at first only in the infrared. And it performed a number of other experiments that we continue to this day, including the creation of field-aligned plasma irregularities in the ionosphere. And these irregularities are actually important for a number of reasons. They affect radio communication and navigation, and they also occur naturally too, especially at high latitudes. And in fact, they're the main way that we can allow us to use high-frequency radars to get a very large coverage of the horizontal plasma winds in the ionosphere through like the SuperDARN network. And they're basically space plasma winds, and they're important for understanding geomagnetic storms. Some of the conspiracy theories say now that there are HARPs all over the world, and that's also partially true. Several facilities were built following Platteville. The question marks on the slide indicate uncertainties have been expressed in one form or another about the future of the facility, and an X indicates that the facility has already been remediated. And these facilities include Arecibo, originally built as an ionosphere and space radar, also as a space telescope as well. And it had several heating facilities or devices. One of the first was located near, but not quite at, Arecibo, and it was destroyed by Hurricane Andrew shortly after construction. So eventually a new heating facility was constructed recently in the dish itself, sort of a reverse Cassegrain telescope in a way. And that was shortly before Hurricane Maria hit Arecibo and Puerto Rico, an event from which the facility and as you know, the island itself are still recovering. The Incoherent Scatter Radar Facilities, or ICECAT, they have a large heating facility at Tromsø, Norway, and they also have a smaller heating facility called, or had a smaller heating facility called Spear at the Svalbard Archipelago. The Tromsø heater was unique in that it used three different antenna arrays, but only one at a time, and they were for different frequency ranges. And one of those antennas was destroyed by a storm in October 1985 and rebuilt several years later. Spear is relatively low power and has also since been remediated. The high power auroral stimulation, or HIPAS, facility was built by the University of California, Los Angeles, near Two Rivers, Alaska, about 30 miles east of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and has also since been remediated. Also an interesting story by that. But anyways, when they disassembled that, the local junk scavengers had an absolute field day when HIPAS equipment was sold to auction. And those scavengers have been salivating ever since at the thought that the same fate may eventually befall HARP. Finally, the Sura ionosphere modification facility was constructed in the former Soviet Union, now Russia, and is located about 600 kilometers east of Moscow. It is still in operation, and as I repeatedly told the Russian media, I would love to visit their so-called climate weapon facility someday. Those weren't the words I used, but I tried to emphasize that they have one too. They shouldn't keep picking on HARP. So finally, that brings us to the HARP array, the most powerful and exquisite radio modification facility in the world. We prefer the term observatory because the actual effects of ionosphere modification are basically imperceptible without very sensitive instruments to detect them. And near the center of the image, of course, is the 40-acre phased array antenna, and off to the left is the control and generator room, a UHF ionosphere radar similar to but much smaller than the incoherent scatter radars located at Poker Flat, Alaska, is near the control room, a little bit above and to the right. It can detect plasma waves in the ionosphere stimulated by powerful HF radio waves from HARP, and that was the fancy slide I showed at the beginning. The other science pads contain a number of instruments, including telescopes, an ionoson, sort of like a variable frequency radar in the HF band designed for measuring the underside ionosphere plasma density, VLF receivers, magnetometers, rheometers, and even seismometers. Now, the presence of seismometers at the HARP site does not mean that HARP is generating earthquakes, rather that Alaska is a great place to study earthquakes because we have them all the time, literally, we have them all the time. And the HARP facility is a great place to put scientific instruments because it has space, lots of space, also has power, internet, and technical support. And so this diagram shows the relative capabilities of each ionosphere heating facility, past and present, as measured by the effective radiated power, which is often misused in the conspiracy literature. And the ERP is a measure of both the net power that's actually generated by the generators and output by the amplifiers, and the ability of the antenna to focus that power. And the physical dimensions or the size of the antenna really determines how well the antenna can focus the radio waves at any given frequency. And since the net power from the generators and amplifiers at each facility is usually constant, the ERP generally varies with frequency in a way that depends on the antenna dimensions at each facility. But what makes HARP unique is not that it's just the most powerful radio in the planet, practically, for this type of purpose. It's that it's also the most flexible. It can, for example, be split into two arrays of various shapes, each transmitting at different radio frequencies. The beam can steer in various directions or be reshaped in various ways, each and it can be changed about every 5 microseconds or so. So it can swing around really fast. The beam amplitude can be modulated with a sample rate of 200 kilohertz and frequency modulated within a similar range and operated in a CW or on-off fashion with pulses about as rapid. So these blurry photos, for which I apologize, are the some of the actual screens at the HARP control system, which runs a standard version of Red Hat Linux or GNU Linux. The main user interface is written in Java. Some of the lower level functions for sending commands to the signal generators and transmitters are written in C and FPGA stuff and whatnot. And a HARP experiment campaign, that's usually how we run. We don't run all the time, very rarely actually. It consists of several scientists all getting together, mostly at HARP, And we provide English descriptions to the HARP operator, who then makes an experiment file for each experiment. And those files are arranged in a job queue. And experiments in the queue are then run one at a time. And HARP is also an electromechanical machine. So every transmitter, all 360 of them for the 180 antenna towers, consists of large variable capacitors, inductors, and vacuum tubes that actually have to physically move when tuned to different frequencies, more than about 100 kilohertz, or 100 or 200 or so. And this process takes about 30 seconds, so there's about a 30-second gap of off time between experiments, and that's charged usually to the previous experiment in the queue. And incidentally, those vacuum tubes in all of those little white trailers that you might see at HARP, and those inductors, they're about 2 feet tall. I mean, they're massive. So HARP is really a serious distributed tube amplifier. So remember that when you're, you know, have some music to play. So one of the displays, the one with the little green in the upper right, shows the current beam shape, and the colors represent two different types of wave polarization, O mode and X mode, basically right hand or left hand polarized. The beam can be steered approximately 30 degrees off the vertical without suffering severe grating lobes. And the two most common directions that people use are usually vertical, just straight up, or up the geomagnetic field line, or the magnetic zenith, which is about 15 degrees off the vertical at Gakona and about 16 degrees off the geographic south. And the other screens sort of near the bottom there show the status of the array, with each box representing one antenna tower. And they frequently go offline. I mean, it's a large machine with a lot of elements, and things do sometimes go wrong. One of the many types of experiments often performed at HARP and other ionospheric heating facilities are artificial airglow or artificial aurora experiments. And my former PhD thesis advisor hates the term artificial aurora. He hates it. And that's because the word aurora just sort of conjures the thoughts of giant luminescent arcs or curtains that fill the sky, while the artificial radio-induced aurora or airglow is more of a spot or a blob, perhaps 50 to 100 kilometers in dimension, with an apparent size about that of your thumbnail held at arm's length. And also, the spot is extremely dim and usually is only detectable by sensitive low-light cameras or telescopes or timed exposures to properly image. And only in a very few instances have the artificial aurora been bright enough to view with the unaided eye. And even in those cases, it was just barely at the visible threshold, or about as bright as the as the Andromeda galaxy, and oftentimes it occurred when temperatures are like 20 or 30 below zero Fahrenheit. So I personally believe that people will see anything to get back into the warmth. My geochronologist colleague incidentally insists on calling it not the artificial aurora but the fake aurora, but you know, he dates rocks for a living, so there's that to consider. The artificial aurora is, in fact, though, like the natural aurora in a few cases, in that every color emitted by the artificial aurora is also found in the natural aurora. The green line, or 5577 angstrom wavelength, or the red line, 6300 emissions from atomic oxygen, are the most common in artificial aurora, and usually the natural aurora, and they're the most intense. The 5577 green emission is usually what you see in pictures of the aurora. And this slide shows the 6300 red line emission on the left. Over HARP, as viewed from Poker Flat, Alaska, about 400 kilometers away. It's a side view. And on the right is the 7774 angstrom, or infrared emission from atomic oxygen ions. And videos of both of these really magnificent artificial auroras are available at the YouTube links below. But to create artificial aurora is actually really easy. If you have a big enough radio transmitter, you just basically transmit a powerful enough radio wave with O-mode polarization at the right frequency, and a small part of the sky will light up. You know, or you can complicate things a little bit further, and you can modulate the amplitude of that radio wave to encode digital information at the same time, similar to how a telephone modem or fax machine encodes information and sound. And this shows the first simultaneous slow-scan television or SSTV images transmitted from HARP that simultaneously created artificial aurora. The experiment was pre-announced on Twitter and the web so people knew when to listen. And these images were received, decoded, and posted to Twitter by an unsolicited volunteer in Victoria, British Columbia. Another set of images were received and posted from Pueblo, Colorado, but with a little bit more degradation because of the distance. And now, of course, these were the images that I showed triumphantly to management, the ones filled with school spirit. But I also sent this poorly doctored photo of my giant cat next to the giant HARP antenna array, which I believe is, pretty sure, it's the first cat pic ever sent with a giant ionosphere heater. And it was the first cat pic that generated an artificial aurora. Incidentally, I also sent a QR code for a private key to a Bitcoin wallet containing a milli Bitcoin, or about enough for a cup of coffee and a donut, even still to this day. And I'm not showing a picture of that for obvious reasons, because that cup of coffee and donut are still sitting unclaimed in the Bitcoin wallet. And so at this point, you might ask, what is the value of burning up 800 gallons of diesel fuel per hour to make a small part of the sky glow, even very faintly, while sending cat pics wirelessly all over the planet? And that's really a fair question. It's a difficult question to answer. In a short amount of time, I could do it eventually. Give me a moment. But the short answer is that we have an incomplete understanding of both the natural aurora and the artificial aurora. But they're clearly related. And so studying one helps us study the other, and vice versa. And there's also gaps in our understanding of the physical processes that convert electromagnetic wave energy from HARP waves with wavelengths of 40 to 100 meters to optical energy emitted by atoms, molecules, and atoms with the scale size of angstroms. I mean, that's 12 orders of magnitude to cover with physics, and that's very difficult. It's also difficult to overestimate the importance to science of creating phenomena like aurora or field-aligned irregularities on demand. Instead of waiting around for them to occur naturally, and when they do, it usually occurs during really stormy conditions that create less than ideal, the complication just compounds and it makes it very difficult to do good science. The last type of experiment I want to talk about is cross-modulation, or the Luxembourg effect that started this entire radio modification to begin with. And again, cross-modulation is where a powerful radio wave passing through a plasma imparts its modulation on another radio wave, powerful or not, passing through the same plasma. In other words, if we have two powerful radio stations transmitting on different frequencies, and those radio waves pass through the same volume of ionosphere plasma, then the modulations of those waves will mix together in the plasma, and the listener will hear both stations on each frequency. So if HARP is operated in a split array configuration, with half the array transmitting a program at one radio frequency and the other half transmitting a different program on another radio frequency, then the programs broadcast on those two frequencies will be mixed together in space approximately relatively equally on each channel, sometimes. And back in 2014, when we thought that the Air Force was going to bulldoze HARP, which is exactly what they said they were going to do, I had an opportunity to be trained in operating the transmitter itself, and basically had an entire day or two to do whatever I wanted with the transmitter, which is an extraordinary and mysterious opportunity when you think about it, 600 to 800 gallons of diesel fuel per hour. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could reproduce the Luxembourg effect, similar to how it occurred in the 1930s, apparent to anybody listening with a shortwave radio? I mean, scientists have been studying this stuff for years, but have only done so in scientifically relevant ways, that with sensitive instruments and whatnot, and they're boring, really. But what if we could have a little bit of fun with it? You know, if you happen to have two giant radio transmitters of about 1.8 megawatts each, what would you do? And there's so few opportunities to bring ionosphere radio modification heating experiments to the public that haven't gone through 20 years of college. However, the artificial aurora is one opportunity, and the Luxembourg effect is another. And so I chose telephone touch tones, specifically DTMF tones, which stands for dual tone multi-frequency signaling. I bet this audience more than most already knows that each touch tone on a telephone, as well as the dial tone, busy tone, et cetera, are simply harmonic intervals, basically two note chords, where the pure tones are played simultaneously to result in the unique sound that we hear for each combination. And of course, as most of you know, this is the very mechanism of controlling the old telephone company switching system with combinations of tones that led to the original phreaking or hacking of the telephone network, starting with the 2600 hertz whistle. And of course, one reason why I chose touch tones for the experiment is because they're familiar to most people, at least for now. And if the Luxembourg effect is present with one half of the array transmitting one tone at one radio frequency and the other half another tone at another radio frequency, then it would be immediately apparent to the listener at either frequency that something unique was happening. And the other reason why I chose touch tones is because I had already written the code to generate wave files as part of a demonstration for a programming class I was teaching for the College of Engineering at UAF. And fortunately, the amplitude modulation of HARP can be defined by wave files. So it really literally is a big radio station that can transmit your playlist with gigawatts of ERP. And so in April 2014, with a collaborator, Simon, a visiting fine arts and performance arts student from Montreal, after many attempts, we finally successfully recorded what I believe may be the first audio frequency reproduction of the Luxembourg effect since the 1930s. And Simon was recording the audio with shortwave radios outside of Fairbanks, and I was at HARP, and this is the result. So that's the frequencies tuned to. That's the Luxembourg effect. And so this is sequentially, and then soon will be simultaneously. Okay, so the students really did, so, and I was collaborating with other art students at the time, and they did great, and I thought, well, why don't we compose music to take advantage of this effect, have two independent tracks, they stood alone on their own, you know, but if they're combined, they would create something unique, and so I asked the students to do this, and they did great, and they composed a very abstract, difficult piece of modern jazz, technically two pieces, that we actually did transmit, but good luck distinguishing any Luxembourg effect from that. And after I was interviewed by NPR's All Things Considered to, on a story they were doing about the HARP remediation, the impending remediation, I was quoted saying something, well, it's like, in retrospect, I wish I had done something like row, row, row your boat. And so I did that. So that's the tuned frequency. There's the Luxembourg effect. And it goes on from there, and I've provided the YouTube links so you can listen to these offline or online. And so that was done by a collaborator of mine, Jeff Dooms, KL4IU, and he composed those tracks and also played them. And he had such fun with that he also was able to do the first crowdsource experiment later, crowdsource funded experiment. And he actually looked at a science aspect of the Luxembourg effect. And so this is the first ever one that he did. And it turned out that He did this scientific experiment, closed it out with a very rocking version of the Star Spangled Banner with his electric guitar, and paid for the entire experiment with a credit card, which is, you know, like a rock star. And we do accept all major credit cards for HARP experiments. So get involved, especially if you have an idea and some money to burn, or if you just have money to burn, bring it to us. We have two or three more experiment campaigns planned, and you know, after that, who knows? That's the funding environment. And if somebody knows, I don't know, they might be giants. I bet they might have a few ideas, and their songs are short, so they probably won't cost very much. So get involved, tune in. Through the Twitters and things, you'll know when HARP is operating, and if you're in the Alaska or Yukon Territory area, you'll have opportunities to focus, to photograph the artificial aurora, but maybe not during the summer. And if you have a shortwave radio, such as the Sea Crane Skywave radio, then you can tune in and listen, and most of the time it just sounds like a DJ forgot to put the next record on and it's silent. But sometimes they do interesting modulations that create interesting timescapes. And if you don't hear anything, I'm sorry, but we just need more power. You know, and more money, yeah, you know how it goes. And if you don't want to listen to HARP, say when we're transmitting at 9,500 kilohertz and you want to listen to Radio China, true story, or you don't expect HARP artificial aurora messing up your view of the night sky from north of the Arctic Circle, another true story, you can see that there, just remember that we don't do this sort of thing very often. Two or three times at most, and when we do, it's just for funsies and for science. So thank you. And I almost forgot, come to the open house next month, August 25th, if you're in the Alaska area. And we do have a campaign coming up very soon. I can't say that, but it's very soon. This summer, my next flight's to Florida, then Fairbanks, then Gakona. So,
website?
It's all in the power. You'll have to review the video.
Okay.
And my Twitter, CT Fallon. I don't do it. Thank you.